This particular reading is, well, the word humdinger comes to mind. We'll see whether the sermon lives up to it or not. You know, this Swamiji sort of lays the foundation. He wrote these commentaries as a 52-week cycle, and he's sort of building. We come around it. There's no, we obviously December comes and then January starts, but after the first year of doing these, we just keep rolling. So we're just starting over again, laying the foundation of the spiritual path that he builds on through the year. I know myself as a writer, sometimes you just build these beautiful castles in the sky, which nobody else ever notices, but they give you this great sense of satisfaction. So Swamiji did all this, and he knew it. He knows it's there. But it's very important early on, we're just thinking in the calendar, but even early on in the spiritual path, either at your actual beginning or if you think of it in terms of your foundation and where what we stand on that everything else is built from. It's extremely important on the spiritual path that the foundation be solid, because we're going to build on our understanding really for incarnations, and anything that wobbles down here is eventually going to cause us a problem. A friend of mine, in the early years of Ananda, we constructed rather helter-skelter with whatever materials we had at hand and what little money we had when we were all just living up in the hills of what is now Ananda Village, but was then much more primitive. Swami Kriyananda's house, which is now called Crystal Hermitage, for those of you who've been there, is built on the edge of a very steep hill, which goes all the way down to the Yuba River. And a lot of the monks then built little kutirs, little cottages, sort of on that hillside. And one man built a whole house there. House for us was, you know, like one small room. He had it all set up. It was built right, cantilevered out from that cliff, incredible view, you know where I'm going with this. And right after he finished it, when fortunately he wasn't at home, it just collapsed and rolled down the hill. The whole thing just fell into the Yuba River just after he bought a propane refrigerator. That was like the last thing. You know? But he said, in actually a very detached manner, that it was actually pretty symbolic of his spiritual life, that he had cantilevered himself way out over the canyon, but that underneath it, he didn't really understand what he was doing. And this whole idea on many, many different meanings of what an avatar is, I know that word has now been co-opted to have an entirely other meaning. So let's just pretend it doesn't. I don't know how else to deal with it. It's a very sacred word, so it's not going to help us. It's not going to help the karma of our culture that we have trivialized a sacred word. And it's just a symbol of many, many other things. But avatar means descent of spirit in the highest sense, the pure spirit descending from above. And it refers to those souls who are completely free, who have obtained absolute self-realization and descend to help us. Descend from that high level of consciousness to the material plane. Their consciousness doesn't change, but their manifestation becomes material. And that's what we're talking about here. Now, the idea of avatars, the idea of these gurus, if you think of every spiritual tradition, everyone that's related to Sanatan Dharma, which is to say, related to the highest truth, the ones that have endured and continue to endure, and in their teachings match the ancient truths that all of us know. This will be Krishna, Buddha, Christ, are the three of the best known, but Zoroaster and Ramakrishna and Patanjali, Chaitanya, there are many others, much more on the Indian side where all these things are kept track of. A fully self-realized master who comes, and then this enormous consequence happens from their single incarnation. And even if their single incarnation, as in almost always happened, in itself, you know, when they were born and died, it wasn't as if the world had really shifted. A certain amount of notice was taken of them, but the real power was so much greater than could be expressed in one incarnation, because it's a full descent of infinity, and a pattern is set that takes many generations for it to finally inch its way into society. And depending on whether the planet is in an upward cycle of consciousness as we are now, or in a downward cycle of consciousness as it was at the time of Krishna and Jesus, where the planet was getting darker and darker, depends how it manifests. Christianity went hidden into the monasteries, and it held that energy, and Gary McSweeney isn't here today, but I'll give him a tribute. And the Irish saved civilization in the monasteries there by holding, but what they held, you see, it was the power of Jesus. I mean, it was the Christian monasteries. Empowered by him, they went into seclusion, they held this high truth, and when the planet shifted, they came up again. The teaching is all manifested according to what's needed. This is getting very cerebral, but we're going to try to find it in a moment again. Right now, we're in an upward moving cycle. And right now, the avatar, one of the avatars most recent, is the one to whom this temple is dedicated, Paramhansa Yogananda, a fully self-realized master who came to bring a particular message for this particular time. And the time we're in right now is a whole lot of people are empowered with darkness, and a lot of people are empowered with goodness. And it hasn't actually come to the final conflict, but it's building. You know, the darkness is getting worse, the light is getting stronger, and it's a tension that cannot be maintained forever. And Yogananda, I mean, the co-opting of the word avatar to me, which could be just dismissed as trivial, does not feel trivial to me. It's the kind of utter disregard for the sacred that is the real force behind this darkness. I mean, bad politicians and dictators and all of that is the manifestation afterwards. It's the absolute disregard for the sacred that makes them dark. No respect for humanity, no respect for higher values, not even really respect for themselves, except in terms of power and appetite and indulgence. And that's what it is. There's nothing sacred here. Or even the communist philosophy that just disregards humanity. It's just like, what do we matter? And this side considers everything sacred. You see, it's an impossible conflict. But Yogananda manifested to lay the groundwork for an ascending age, which is why our temple is on El Camino in Palo Alto. When we were originally looking for a temple, which was back now in 1994, quite a long time ago, the search for a church went on for about six years or so. And we found a couple of other places that never came through, but we tended to be looking in environments that pleased us. You know, much more secluded, much more rural, much more land around it. You know, the last thing we wanted was the intermittent sound of the buses and the sirens. But none of that ever came through, and this is the one that was given to us. And when we finally closed in and were going to buy it, Swami Kriyananda, whose parents lived in Atherton and would visit here often, he just said to us rather casually, "Oh yes, that's the one I always thought would be ours." Could have saved us a lot of trouble, sir. But he never presumed on his intuition. In fact, truthfully, we had heard that this was Catholic. We had heard that the Catholic was going to consolidate some of their dioceses, and that therefore they would have extra real estate. And we called someone, and they told us, in fact, it was true, but it took them 7 years to do it. And in fact, they finally did exactly that. And when they did it, this one became available and it became ours. It's symbolic to me of the, you know, the shifting of the guard from the old institutional to the new way. Just for fun, I'll tell you, when we first were doing services here, at that time, all the light bearers were white. This was before the Nyaswami order. And the church had been set up in the old fashion with the huge cross here and the big table. And the church had been built in the 30s or the 40s, I think. So it was built for the priest to have his back to the congregation as they used to do it. And then at some point, they came around and started facing it. This church was a devoted Catholic church for the 40s until we bought it in 94. So that's 40, almost 50 years. The first time I'm standing here, female, white, I mean, dressed in white, not black, not speaking Latin, I actually felt the spirit of all these priests back there. I mean, I couldn't actually see them, but I could almost see them. They were annoyed. It's the only word I can think of. And it went on in some way for more than one Sunday. Finally, I just, inside myself, I just said, get over it. You know, like, I bear you no malice. I'm grateful for this church, but it's not yours anymore. It belongs to the new wave. And then after that, they kind of crumpled and, you know, went away. But you can imagine, everybody's committed to what they're doing, and you love it. Your spirit hangs out a little bit. Whether any of that was true or not, I don't know, but it felt true to me. But that was, we still pray to Christ. It's not as if we have repudiated Christ. In fact, Master called his teaching the second coming of Christ. So I think it's quite appropriate that self-realization should move in. The Catholic Church, by this time, is a somewhat different reality from the teachings of Christ. That's why Master said the original teachings of Christ, as opposed to what he called churchianity. Now, coming through all of this, Master was here for many years. He came in 1920, and in 1948, which compared to eternity is a very short period of time, but it was a solid part of his American life, Yogananda's American life, he wrote and published Autobiography of a Yogi. Actually, it came out in 1947. So he obviously, that was the Autobiography of a Yogi has been, you know, the vanguard of what you would call the ship of Yogananda's spirit. You know, in this age, a book is really what does it. And the number of people in the world who have read Autobiography of a Yogi and been influenced by it is really quite astonishing. Only a certain number have given their lives to it, but the influence of it is just really incredible. I'll tell you one story. I'll tell you two. The first was from Ananta, who's the minister of Comparable in Sacramento. He told this whole story, which is in the book Loved and Protected, Miracles and Answered Prayers. And his story was all about, it was a very mundane situation, although a serious one. They had taken the roof off their church, ripped it off because it needed to be replaced, and he needed to replace it, and he couldn't get the city to give him the permit he needed. And as he put it, those little pictures with the raindrops were getting closer and closer on the, and so he had no roof essentially on his church, and it was about to rain. And he just couldn't get the city to listen to him, so he called up the, he's talking to a guy, and he says, I'm the pastor of the Self-Realization Church, and so on. And the guy said, Self-Realization, is that about Yogananda? Hey, you know, and I read that book 20 years ago, he said. And then he and Ananda have a little conversation about self-realization, and 2 hours later he had his permit. For us here, when we were remodeling our community, that we live in over on, in Mountain View, very old buildings, very complicated remodel. It was a big deal. Oh, let me think. No, that's not true. It was when the house was built that we presently live in, the house that's called Chelabhavan, and it was. We played it really dicey right up to the edge with the permits, and there were just lots of issues involved. Now, I'm not even now quite sure which one. The real point is this. We had an inspector, a building inspector, who was an ordinary seeming building inspector. They're kind of gruff. They have a strong exterior because everybody's always trying to get something from them and they're not about to give it to you. So this whole thing goes on and on. But time after time, it kept breaking in the right direction. And finally at the end, whether which house or whether it was the community, one of the builders, actually it was Diva, who's now in Portland, he just starts talking to this guy. And the guy talks about the fact that he saw Yogananda's picture all over this. Turns out his mother was a direct disciple. And as a child, he had had a miracle cure. Not that he remembered, but he had been miraculously saved by Yogananda. And now he's our building inspector, right? So there's so many ways in which this influence just goes out. And Autobiography of a Yogi is one of the huge ones. The first sentence of Autobiography of a Yogi, the characteristic feature of English, of Indian culture, the culture of India, has always been the search for eternal verities and the concomitant disciple-guru relationship. Okay, that's the very first sentence of this book that Master knows is going to go on for generations and is going to touch and ultimately transform undoubtedly millions and millions of lives. And it begins, the search for eternal truth will lead inevitably to the disciple-guru relationship. Now, discipleship is not like the American characteristic. The American characteristic is, thank you very much, I'll do it myself. You know, don't tread on me. That's what New Hampshire had. You know, just, I will do it myself. This is the tremendous power of this country. And it really cannot be underestimated. As Master said, Americans say, you know, eventually, why not now? Which is Master, Lahiri put it in a different way. But Master said, you drive by in the morning and it's an empty lot. In the afternoon, there's a building on it. You know, he really loved that spirit. That nothing can hold us back, and that's why we have become such a wealthy country, such an effective country in so many ways. We're not really looking around for somebody to tell us how to do it. But there is an eternal verity here. There is a divine truth. And this is part of Sanatana Dharma, that you do not attain self-realization without the help of a guru. Now, at first, this seems very confusing because it sounds very much like the very principles of churchianity that Master came to reject, which is that you can't get to heaven without the intercession of the priest, and not just any priest, but the priest of our particular church, and not just any one of them, but the appointed one, and have to have the right ceremonies, and incidentally, it may cost you a little. My friend, an Indian man, I mean, Hinduism is just as confused. He said, Hinduism, you can't practice Hinduism on your own. He said, you have to get a pujari, a priest, to practice it for you. You have to hire a priest to do the proper ceremonies. And it's a whole profession to know how to do the proper ceremonies. It's not institutionalized in the same way, but it's the same deal. It seems like there's a necessary intermediary. So simultaneously, Master also taught us Kriya Yoga. The only place where God can be worshipped, Master said, is in the human nervous system, which is the most unpoetic combination of words, and it offends me every time I say it. But the meaning is that it is in our own self that God is experienced. It's not in the church, it's not in the confessional, it's not in the ceremony, it's not in the Vedic ritual in front of the sacred fire. It's our own consciousness. And Kriya Yoga practice in all its many aspects puts the responsibility for our spiritual lives right into our own hands, which is, Americans like that a great deal. But then he throws in this disciple-guru relationship, and you have all these masters on the altar, and we have these prayers in which we name all the gurus. So it's this, and this is the right foundation that I was talking about. We have to understand both the unlimited nature of our own potential and also the limited nature of our own potential. or the limited nature of our ability to reach our potential without help. Swami Kriyananda's marvelous answer when challenged, as people often challenge him, especially more in the early years, I don't need a guru. Why do I need a guru? Do I have to have a guru? Swami says, not if you don't think so. If you don't think you need a guru, then you don't. Because need a guru depends on what you're trying to accomplish. And I'm not specifically talking about discipleship to a master, but the idea that there are perfected beings who come back to this planet and that they are the necessary guides. And that without that guidance, we're sunk. But not if you don't think so, because you have to reach the point where you realize that what you want is beyond what you can grasp with your own mind and your own will all by yourself. And nobody can persuade you of that. I mean, you can have respect for spiritual authority. You can have respect for those who seem to have what you want. When I was 22 years old, in 1969, I had the extraordinary blessing to meet Swami Kriyananda. That was my first meeting with him. It was just before Thanksgiving in 1969. I knew about self-realization at that point. I had been studying the teachings of Ramakrishna, very high lineage. Ramakrishna himself was an avatar. He lived in the 1800s in India, and his power was ever present. And he has many temples in this country, and I would go to some of them and meet some of the swamis who ran those temples. The teaching was extremely elevated and completely consistent with what I follow now, but just a different family, so to speak. But there I was, and I would go over to East West Bookstore, which was then in Menlo Park, and I would go to the shelves and buy all the books and study the books. But every morning, I just got up, and I went to work, and I kind of hacked around at the little job I had. Then I went home, then I had my dinner, then I visited with the people who were my people at that time, and then I went to sleep, and then I got up, and then I went and I hacked at my little job again, then I went home. And Yogananda has a phrase in Autobiography of a Yogi. It says, anguishing monotony. And Thoreau says, most men live lives of quiet desperation. I was 20 years old. I mean, it seems a little young to already be there, but I was there. And I'm reading everything there is to read. I may have made some feeble attempts at meditation. Eventually, I started trying to meditate. But I was smack up against the fact that it was, you know, I was incapable of seeing past the consciousness I already had. I could hear that there was another consciousness. I could believe there was another consciousness. But no matter what I did, it was like a brick wall around me. I didn't have the power to lift myself up. You know, there's a great mythical liar in literature, and he tells the story of being able to lift himself up by his own hair. You know, that's the ultimate sort of joke, that you can lift yourself by your own hair. But that's sort of what it felt like. I wanted to, I knew it was there, but I couldn't seem to get off the ground. Then I walked into the room. Well, actually, I was sitting in the room, and Swami Kriyananda walked into the room. I'd been told about him, excuse me. A friend of mine, actually, Lakshmi Selby, she lives at Ananda Village still. I knew her way back when. She had met Swami Kriyananda, and she had phoned me. She said, I have met a real teacher, and I think you'll like him. That was what she said. And so I went. But that's pretty much all I knew. He walked into the room, and all of a sudden, I saw the consciousness. I don't know how I knew. I really don't. But he came in like this, and he was different than anyone I'd ever met, ever. And it was like my own consciousness was a box, and I could feel it like this. And I wanted to get past it. But one of my first ideas to get past it when I was much younger was that I would have a dozen children. I would multiply myself. And then somewhere in there, I realized that they would all still be on the other side of the box. That it wouldn't actually break the box. And I realized that it was my own limitations that was torturing me. And then Swami walked in, and the only way I can describe it is that I could not see or feel the edge of him. And I was in a room smaller than this one, but I was as far away from him as it was possible to be, because the people I were with wanted to be there, but not really. So they were against the far back wall. But he walked in, his consciousness came all the way to me and just sailed past me. And I just didn't know where it was. And my first thought was, he has it. He has what I want. It was not rational. It was just a bigger part of me knew. And how to get from here to there, I didn't have the foggiest idea. I could have quoted all the books to you. I could have even said the very same words, but I didn't know. So that was the point at which, yeah, I did need a guru. And I was looking at someone who could take me there. Now, he talked to me about yoga. He talked to us about Yogananda, about Autobiography of a Yogi, which was all vaguely known to me. But none of it had touched me until I saw it manifested. Now, Swami Kriyananda is not on the planet now. Yogananda is not on the planet now. But the power that is them never leaves. Never leaves. It's really quite something to think of. In terms of the power of pilgrimage, Yogananda said, wherever a great master has ever lived, his consciousness remains there forever. And really, truly, where a master lives is anywhere that we draw him. In the festival, every week, we have that song, "When We Need You, You Descend. Our human griefs your love alone can mend." By proud indifference unaffected, what that means is, no matter how many times the planet or I myself reject him, proud indifference. That's what's going on the planet right now, isn't it? Proud indifference. Though proud indifference, though eternally rejected, meaning that ignorance keeps on going. And then the line is so powerful. You remain our friend. And that's the reason. Why does the avatar descend? Why does the master come to this planet? They have nothing to gain. Believe me. Limitation willingly to it from a life of infinite joy and freedom in God. This is also from the festival. Willingly to embrace limitation, pain, and death. This is what Swami says in the reading. The master lives like all of us and seems to suffer like all of us. Willingly to embrace limitation, pain, and death for the salvation of mankind. So that somewhere we pick up Autobiography of a Yogi, we look at a picture of Yogananda, we go somewhere and we feel the presence of Christ, we go into a Buddhist temple and we can tell that there is something there that I don't have, that I want. And as soon as we say, "I want," the master, that opens the door. The avatara descends. He descends to the planet, but where he really descends is into our own hearts. And at a certain point, in our spiritual life, it becomes a relationship. And when the relationship begins, this is when Master says, "Now I'll take charge of your life." God bless you.